This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Israel's military struck Islamic Jihad targets in Gaza on Wednesday for a second day as Palestinian militants fired back, setting off sirens and sending residents to shelters as far away as Tel Aviv. Reuters correspondent Edward Baran reports.
Gaza, multiple contrails could be seen ascending as rockets were launched. Mid-air explosions signaled interceptions by Israel's Iron Dome aerial defense system. On Tuesday, Israel launched a series of strikes it said were aimed at senior leaders of Islamic Jihad, responsible for planning attacks against Israel. At least 10 civilians were killed in the strikes, as well as three senior commanders. Islamic Jihad had promised to retaliate for the strikes.
That was Reuters correspondent Edward Baran. Fighting in Sudan's capital escalated on Wednesday with fierce clashes and airstrikes, but rival military factions were reported to be close to a ceasefire agreement in talks in Saudi Arabia. Residents reported ground battles in several neighborhoods of Khartoum between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. The army has been pounding targets since Tuesday as it tries to root out RSF forces that have taken control of large residential areas and strategic sites since early in the conflict that erupted on April 15th. Pakistan's government has called out the military in provinces plagued by violence following the arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The popular opposition leader was dragged from a courtroom and ordered held for another 8 days on new corruption charges, outraging his supporters and deepening the country's political turmoil. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif approved the deployment of troops in the capital Islamabad and in the volatile northwest. This is VOA News. U.S. Republican Congressman George Santos has been charged in a web of fraud, including stealing from his campaign to buy designer clothes. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Santos faces charges of wire fraud, money laundering, theft of public funds, and making false statements to Congress. An indictment states he stole from his campaign and took undeserved unemployment benefits. Majority Leader Steve Scalise.
There is a legal process. The charges just came out. We just saw some of them this morning. And so in America, there's a presumption of innocence, but they're serious charges. He's going to have to go through the legal process.
But Democratic Representative Ted Lieu says the House can do more if the GOP wants to.
The House is not a criminal court of law. The House has its own rules. The House can choose to expel a member.
Julie Walker, New York.
India's Prime Minister is set to make a state visit to the United States next month and will be the guest of honor for a formal dinner at the White House. The story from VOA's chief and national correspondent, Steve Herman.
The White House announced on Wednesday that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi will make an official visit that will include a state dinner on June 22nd. Officials say the trip is intended to boost bilateral ties, including strengthening the defense partnership and confronting common challenges such as climate change. India is the world's largest democracy and most populated country. Modi faces international criticism for his government's crackdowns on the media and for limiting the rights of minority Muslims. Washington increasingly sees India as a bulwark against rising China, but New Delhi has resisted a formal military alliance with the United States. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Detailed talks on raising the U.S. government's $31 trillion debt ceiling kicked off Wednesday, with Republicans insisting on deep spending cuts. The talks convened today after Democratic President Joe Biden and Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's first meeting in 3 months. Time is running out to avoid a historic, economically destabilizing default, which the Treasury Department has warned could come as soon as June 1st. A new study finds an experimental skin patch shows promise to treat toddlers who are highly allergic to peanuts. There is no cure for this common allergy. The only treatment is for children 4 and older who can consume a special powder to train their bodies to tolerate an accidental bite. The patch aims for a similar treatment absorbed through the skin. Researchers reported toddlers who wore a daily patch for a year could safely eat a few peanuts. You can find more on this story and all the stories we're covering at voanews.com. I'm Richard Green reporting for VOA News.
Ukraine's Atomic Energy Agency sounds alarm as Russia plans to relocate thousands of qualified personnel.
The producer adds removing staff would exacerbate the already extremely urgent issue of staff shortages.
Plus, the United States beefs up the border with an expected surge of migrants as a COVID-era asylum rule is set to end.
Officials say the search of migrants from around the world has increased, and even more are expected after pandemic-era border restrictions known as Title 42 come to an end.
And the top U.S. doctor warns of a looming health crisis due to a growing epidemic of loneliness and isolation. Today is Thursday, May 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. Ukraine's state-owned nuclear power plant operator warned on Wednesday that Russia planned to evacuate thousands of workers from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest nuclear plant. Russia has occupied the site since the early stages of its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and fighting near the facility has occurred regularly. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Ukraine's atomic energy company says Moscow plans to relocate around 2,700 Ukrainian staff from Europe's largest nuclear plant, warning of a potential catastrophic lack of qualified personnel. Ukraine power producer Energoatom says in a Telegram post, workers who signed employment contracts with Russia's nuclear agency Rosatom following Moscow's capture of the plant early in the war are set to be taken to Russia along with their families. The producer adds, removing staff would exacerbate the already extremely urgent issue of staff shortages. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, the U.S. for the first time has sent Ukraine an unspecified amount, possibly millions of dollars, that were seized from the U.S. accounts of a Russian oligarch to help in the fight against Russia's invasion. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, who authorized the payment to the Kyiv government, said the money was seized from Konstantin Malofayev, who had been blacklisted for violating sanctions imposed on Russia after its invasion of Ukraine. U.S. diplomats told lawmakers on Wednesday they are cautiously optimistic that Sudan's warring factions will agree to a temporary humanitarian ceasefire during peace talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Since mid-April, at least 750 people have been killed in fighting and hundreds of thousands displaced. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the U.S. response.
Fighting in Sudan entering a fourth week. The sound of gunfire in the streets of the capital, Khartoum, even as peace negotiations between Commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and Army Chief Abdel Fattah Burhan appear to be taking a positive turn during meetings in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland.
If this stage is successful, and I talked to our negotiators this morning who are cautiously optimistic, it would then enable expanded talks with additional local, regional, and international stakeholders towards a permanent cessation of hostilities, and then a return to civilian-led rule, as the Sudanese people have demanded for years.
Burhan led a military coup in 2021, an upheaval lawmakers said the United States had failed to address. Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Senator Bob Menendez.
Instead of imposing sanctions, we put the democratic aspirations of millions of Sudanese in the hands of generals despite evidence of their complicity in and responsibility for gross violations of human rights and significant public corruption.
Sudan was supposed to be undergoing a transition to democratic government. The conflict has upended that timing, and some Republican lawmakers say the Biden administration has still not developed a strategy. Republican Senator Jim Risch.
I call for the administration to articulate a clear vision for what it wants in Sudan. I'm still waiting.
Last week, the White House authorized sanctions that can be targeted at anyone undermining Sudan's stability. And other lawmakers said the ongoing peace negotiations have a clear goal. Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen.
We want to see a ceasefire. We want to see a hold to give time to negotiations. The ultimate goal, of course, is to get Sudan back onto the path toward a democracy where the people of Sudan can have their say.
More than a third of Sudan's population required humanitarian assistance before the conflict started, according to the U.S. State Department. And now the situation is much worse. Sarah Charles at the USAID Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance.
More than 700,000 people have been internally displaced, and more than 170,000 people have crossed into neighboring countries, meaning that the ramifications of this conflict do not end at Sudan's borders. They stretch into the region, compounding existing humanitarian needs across several countries.
State Department officials told lawmakers it has successfully evacuated 1,300 of the 5,000 Americans registered in Sudan, with the remaining choosing to stay on. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Pakistan's army has been called to maintain security in the capital and two of the country's four provinces following angry protests over the arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Reports say several people have been killed and many more injured. VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman has more on the growing political tensions that have put a spotlight on the country's powerful military.
Another day of angry protest and police action in Pakistan after paramilitary troops arrested former Prime Minister Imran Khan on Tuesday.
Imran Khan's arrest is illegal and unconstitutional. We are protesting since yesterday, and we will protest till Khan's release.
In the nation's capital, Islamabad, police used tear gas to push back demonstrators. As the security situation worsened throughout the day, authorities called in the army in half the country to help maintain security. Khan's arrest in a corruption case came soon after he repeated the accusation that a top intelligence official is conspiring to kill him. He did not provide evidence. Leaders of Khan's party say the former prime minister is not against the powerful military.
Every organization has people who do wrong things, and therefore identifying them, naming them, does not mean that you're putting a question mark on the organization, unless the organization itself then decides that we are above the law.
In a stern statement several hours after demonstrators breached multiple military installations, the military accused Khan's party of organizing an anti-army campaign, calling it a hypocritical, power-hungry group. Analysts say Khan's public falling out with the military after his ouster last year has left the powerful institution with few options.
Even a serious situation, army has taken over. But now, actually, the army seems to be not in a position to directly take over because it has become very controversial. It does not have support from any quarter of the population. And I think probably and the situation is such that army commander would not like to get power at this point of time.
Defending Khan's arrest, a government minister called the violence an attack against Pakistan.
They were against the people of Pakistan and they were against the state of Pakistan because they targeted important state institutions. They targeted important state infrastructure.
As the arrest of the country's most popular political leader continued to foment anger against the military, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, in a nationwide address, warned of exemplary punishment for those whom he called the state's enemies. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
This week marks the end of the coronavirus restrictions on asylum that have allowed the U.S. to quickly expel migrants at the southern border with Mexico. For the past 3 years, the Biden administration is preparing for an increase in migrants. Some migrant shelters along the U.S.-Mexico border are now reporting they are filled to capacity. In Reynosa, a Mexican town on the Texas border, some nonprofit organizations are stepping up to help migrants as they arrive. For VOA News, Victor Castillo has the story.
Pastor Hector Silva, who operates this shelter for immigrants in Reynosa, Mexico, says that the number of people arriving at the Texas-Mexico border is nonstop.
Every day, we have between 400 to 450 people arriving.
450 están llegando
Officials say the search of migrants from around the world has increased, and even more are expected after pandemic-era border restrictions known as Title 42 come to an end on May 11th.
We have Chinese families, which surprises me a lot, how they are coming. We had a Chechen family. We have Russian families. And we have families from all over the world.
Due to the lack of space in shelters, some migrant families camp on the street.
It's difficult because they ask for water, food, and you don't have it.
It is made of two little blankets. This one we brought from Tehuchitlan, a twig that we have standing there, and, well, the other rags with stones.
Migrants lucky enough to find space in shelters cram into tents. Others have no place and stay wherever they can, sometimes in appalling conditions.
In abandoned houses, abandoned cars, on the street, there is no place to put them, even here in the camp. Also, tents are already insufficient.
In the two Senda de Vida shelters in Reynosa, the migrant population is over 8,500 people, according to organizers.
We have children, we have family, and in Venezuela, I'm being persecuted.
The White House says it plans to send 1,500 military troops to help with administrative tasks and provide other support for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. For VOA News, Victor Hugo Castillo, McAllen, Texas.
Here are some of the other stories from around the world. Thailand's former prime minister, who has lived in self-exile since the army overthrew him in 2006, plans to return home in July, causing a stir as voters prepare to go to the polls in a general election on Sunday, in which his daughter is the frontrunner. Nicaragua has ordered the closure of the country's Red Cross, capping a crackdown that has seen the government toss out religious orders, charities, and civic groups. The legislature voted to shutter the Nicaraguan Red Cross, accusing it of attacks on peace and stability for helping treat injured protesters during anti-government demonstrations in 2018. And Google disclosed plans Wednesday to infuse its dominant search engine with more advanced artificial intelligence technology, a drive that's in response to one of the biggest threats to its long-established position as the Internet's main gateway. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in a new study theorize that life on Earth was jump-started by an active sun blasting our planet with solar particles. An international team of scientists mixed a variety of gases that corresponded with what is thought to represent Earth's early atmosphere. They then fired protons, which simulated solar particles at the gas mixture. The researchers found that their experiment produced amino and carboxylic acids, which are two of the building blocks of life on Earth. One of the study's authors conducted previous research that found that while the sun was 30% dimmer 100 million years ago, it blasted out very rare high-energy super solar flares at the Earth every 3 to 10 days, kickstarting chemical reactions in our atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Israel's Air Force hit Islamic Jihad targets in Gaza for a second day on Wednesday, and Palestinian militants in the enclave began launching rockets across the border, setting off sirens and sending residents to shelter as far away as Tel Aviv. Reuters correspondent Edward Baran reports.
Israel's Air Force hit Islamic Jihad targets in Gaza for a second day on Wednesday, and Palestinian militants in the enclave began launching rockets across the border. Sirens sounded and people, including these beachgoers in Tel Aviv, were sent running for shelter. Esti Shabelis lives in Tel Aviv.
It's frightening for both sides. It's frightening for us. Yes, to run to shelters. I recall the past and that was terrible. And I think it's terrible for Palestinian children who don't have shelters as well. So I can feel for both sides, and it's a very, very sad situation.
The military said it was trying to hit rocket sites preemptively as blasts rocked different points, including what witnesses described as a training camp in the northern part of the Gaza Strip and an open area in the south. Several were killed, medical officials said. Their identities were not immediately clear. Minutes after the strike, sirens sounded in Israel, initially among border communities, but soon also in and around the commercial capital Tel Aviv, 37 miles north of Gaza. There was no immediate word of casualties in Israel. The local media reported that a home was hit in the town of Sderot. In Gaza, multiple contrails could be seen ascending as rockets were launched. Mid-air explosions signaled interceptions by Israel's Iron Dome aerial defense system. On Tuesday, Israel launched a series of strikes it said were aimed at senior leaders of Islamic Jihad, responsible for planning attacks against Israel. At least 10 civilians were killed in the strikes, as well as 3 senior commanders. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for Wednesday's rockets. Islamic Jihad had promised to retaliate for the strikes.
Reuters reporter Edward Baran. Last week, at the start of Mental Health Awareness Month, the U.S. Surgeon General released a report on what he calls a growing health crisis in America due to loneliness and isolation, which the report said can be as costly to a person's health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. I talked about it with Dr. Kirsten Gerst Emerson, Associate Clinical Director at Georgia State University, who studies loneliness.
I think the one thing that struck people was the comparison to not just feeling sad, but that it has real and meaningful impacts on your physical health.
It really brought it to the forefront. It's been happening for a long time, and there have been vulnerable populations throughout history of people that have felt lonely, and we just haven't really talked about it, especially not in terms of a public health or a public national conversation.
And this, according to the data, preceded the pandemic, but the pandemic, as the Surgeon General said, poured fuel on a flame.
It's stunning when you put it in those terms. And, you know, we talk a lot about smoking cessation and obesity, and those are obviously really important. But this is as important, if not more important, to our health outcomes. And we don't ever talk about loneliness until this kind of call to action came out. And that is a really stark way to put it. It's as bad as smoking cigarettes every day. And the higher risk factor is obesity. Yeah, we've been studying it for a long time, and it's been very much a research conversation, but not as much as a national topic of conversation. So I love that it's happening. And one of the big things in research that we think about a lot is chronic versus temporary loneliness. You know, being lonely for a day because your family just left and they had been visiting you for the weekend is a normal part of the human range of emotions, right? We're not usually worried about that. But it's for people that have been lonely for months or even years and they're not getting their social needs met. That's when we really start seeing these negative health outcomes or this kind of cost on our society. And so that's been really important. And that's definitely been increasing across time. It's hard to measure it, but whatever measures we use, we can see that it's gotten worse over time.
You've been studying this. The Surgeon General recommended that the government actually fund research on loneliness to understand the problem. What are you learning from your studies about what's increasing the cause, what we can do as a society to treat loneliness as a public health issue?
I think there's a lot of solutions. Actually, technology can help in some ways, as long as we're using it for good and not for evil, right? Connecting with people across the globe to long-lost family or friends with video chat is great. It doesn't replace human-to-human interaction, but it can help. But one of the things that technology is really tricky with is that we are not usually fully present when we're on technology. And I'm as guilty as anyone when my phone is in my hands. I'm not as present in the conversation as I would be otherwise. And so often technology takes us away as much as it brings us together. And so some of that first step is, and I think Dr. Murphy mentioned this, is to be actually just thoughtful and aware of what that's doing to us. You know, we kind of know that it takes us away, but to realize that this is affecting us biologically, psychologically, and behaviorally, technology can pull us away from others. And we want to use it to connect ourselves with others. Social media can be negative, right? There's a lot of fear of missing out or comparisons to others. It can definitely make you feel even more lonely and more disconnected. And that fear of missing out is real, especially for the younger generation, but it's just as true for older adults as well. And that certainly doesn't help. But if you use social media to connect people, if you can have group chats with others, that can start to make a dent in the needs for people's social interaction. But we do still really want human-to-human personal interactions, as I think we all discovered after COVID, that it can't really be replaced. And I think Dr. Murphy's call to action really mentions that, right? It needs to be a priority on many levels. Technology is one part, but, you know, even infrastructure. If you're living in a city without good sidewalks or safe paths to walk, you're much less likely to go outside and take your dog on a walk or say hello to someone who does regularly walk their dog in the neighborhood. It can be programs or initiatives that communities are funding to try to get more interaction, hosting yoga on the lawn or something that can be really great for physical as well as mental connection, but also that social connection. And then one of the things that he also mentions in his report, or even the entire report mentions, which I really like, is that individuals can make a difference. You know, you can make connections a priority for yourself, minimizing distractions when you're out and actually having those connections, but also just being open and vulnerable when you're able to admit, hey, I think I need to talk. I think I need to reach out. Also, you can make a difference in the lives of others. Say hello to that person who's walking the dog in your neighborhood. It's called a weak connection in research, but even weak connections can make a difference. Say hello to the grocery store clerk. Making that effort and reaching out can make a difference for you, but it can also really make a difference in that other person's life, which is pretty incredible. So, you know, I think Dr. Murthy rightfully talks about this huge societal shift that we need, and I couldn't agree more. But we can also do things kind of at the micro individual level, which is nice because a lot of times in our big public health challenges, we don't feel like as individuals we can do much. But in terms of loneliness, we can. We can do things for ourselves, for our others, in our lives as well.
That's Dr. Kirsten Gerst Emerson, Associate Clinical Director at Georgia State University. Eurovision 2023 is kicked off in Liverpool, Northern England, where acts from 37 countries are now competing to win the 67th edition of the Song Contest. Liverpool is hosting on behalf of Ukraine, which won the contest last year with Kalush Orchestra's Stefania. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have yourselves a really great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 2003, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and restarted its nuclear weapons program. 3 years later, the DPRK conducted its first nuclear test. In an effort to force the DPRK to end its unlawful ballistic missile and weapons of mass destruction programs, the international groups, including the United Nations and the European Union, imposed on North Korea a series of economic and financial sanctions, broadening and tightening them as the nuclear tests escalated. In need of funds to support its nuclear program, the DPRK used the services of numerous individuals to evade sanctions and to obtain money to pay for embargoed goods. For the past 6 years, the DPRK has also engaged in the theft of virtual currency and fraud schemes. In late April, the U.S. Department of State, through its Transnational Organized Crime Rewards Program, announced a reward offer of up to $5 million for information leading to the arrest and/or conviction of North Korean national Sim Hyun-sup. Separate reward offers of up to $500,000 each were offered for information leading to the arrests and/or convictions of Chinese nationals Han Lin Lin and Chen Guming. The United States Department of the Treasury has also sanctioned Sim Hyun-sup plus Wu Hi-hui and Cheng Hung-man. Wu is an over-the-counter virtual currency trader based in China who facilitated the conversion of virtual currency stolen by DPRK actors to fiat currency. Chang, a Hong Kong-based over-the-counter virtual currency trader, worked with Wu to transfer payment to companies in exchange for virtual currency. The DPRK's use of illicit facilitation networks to access the international financial system and generate revenue using virtual currency for the regime's unlawful weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs directly threatens international security, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian E. Nelson. The United States and our partners are committed to safeguarding the international financial system and preventing its use in the DPRK's destabilizing activities, especially in light of the DPRK's 3 launches of intercontinental ballistic missiles this year alone. If you have information on these men, please contact U.S. investigators at +1-520-442-0703 on WhatsApp or Telegram. If you are located outside of the United States, you may also visit the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. If in the United States, you can also contact the local FBI offices in your city.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.